Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. U.S. and Canadian trade negotiators are back at the table today, trying to reach an agreement on NAFTA. Representatives of both the Trump and Trudeau administrations are talking in positive terms, but it's their respective leaders who are taking a much harder line. Here's President Trump just last week offering his direction to U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer.
If you don't have a breakthrough, as you call it, don't do the deal. Because it's a lousy situation for the United States. We have much better alternatives than that, you understand. So if you can't make the right deal, don't make it.
Meanwhile, in Canada, an echo of that toughness, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, even as he insisted there's, quote, a win-win-win possible for NAFTA, he added this.
We will only sign a deal if it is a good deal for Canada. Again, no deal is better than a bad deal for Canada and for Canadians, and that's exactly what we are remaining firm on.
Well, the U.S. auto industry and its workers are watching the back and forth very carefully. The U.S. and Mexico made some major changes to auto manufacturing rules in their bilateral agreement, but modern manufacturing is both a global and hugely North American effort, with billion-dollar supply chains crisscrossing the entire continent that make the cars we drive. This hour on Point, NAFTA, the U.S. auto industry, and what's next for workers and car buyers. You can join us on air or online. Do you work in the auto industry? Are you worried about where the NAFTA negotiations are going? Could you see some kind of agreement without Canada? What effect would that have on car makers and auto workers? And do you think President Trump's trade policy is helping or hurting the industry? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me now from Detroit is Michelle Krebs. She's senior analyst for autotrader.com and automotive industry writer. Michelle, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Kristen Jicek. She's Vice President of Industry, Labor, and Economics at the Center of Automotive Research. Kristen, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you both. So first of all, you know, I want to just start by taking a step back and getting a better understanding about how integrated these supply chains are for auto manufacturers between Mexico, the United States, and Canada. I mean, Michelle, let me just start with you. How would you describe how dependent the three countries are on each other to make the cars that we drive?
Well, ever since the original NAFTA agreement was made a couple dozen years, decades ago, I think of it as a very intricately woven fabric with Mexico production of parts and cars in Canada and the U.S. and crossing borders. And then, of course, you've got parts coming from places like China and South Korea and different places like that, too. So it's a very intricate complicated network.
Mm. I mean, I'm seeing some numbers here. This is an analysis from Brookings that says that the Michigan's automotive industry, relying on suppliers from Canada and Mexico, that they say provides 61% of Michigan's total intermediate imports. And they're saying that Canada and Mexico supply Ohio with nearly $3 billion worth of automotive parts every year. Kristen, does that seem in the ballpark?
Absolutely. You know, these are very important trading partners, especially in the automotive sector. You know, Canada is the number one trading partner for automotive motor vehicle parts for 31 U.S. states for export And Mexico is the number one import partner for 25 U.S. states in motor vehicle parts.
Interesting. So I was trying to figure out, for example, how something like the Ford F-150, right, like one of the most, if not the most popular trucks definitely sold in the United States. It's definitely assembled in Dearborn, Michigan. And also there's a Ford plant in Kansas City. And I think the Super Duty is assembled in Kentucky. But I'm seeing that this very American car, very American made car, still has about, 25 or 30% of each truck uses foreign supplied parts, and a lot of those are from Canada and Mexico, like aluminum from Quebec and windshield wipers from Mexico. So even, Michelle, in this very like what we consider the quintessential American truck, it can't be manufactured today without imports from Canada and Mexico.
Right, and that's one of the more American vehicles. There are other vehicles that are assembled here in the U.S. that have less content than that. And that's one of the things that's being that's been agreed to with the Mexico agreement is an even higher content than we currently have now. Now, it's not quite as high as the president wanted. They originally was 85%. It's at 75%. The law now is 62.5%. So –
yeah. So somewhat of a change there, although, as you said, not as much as the president wanted. So let's talk about that for a second, because the U.S. and Mexico, as you just said, have reached this particular agreement, right? That 75% of the value of the car or the parts of the car have to now be made in North America?
I believe it's the value of the car, and it does differ from the existing NAFTA. The 62.5% is based on a tracing list of specific parts. And it's one of the things that did need to be modernized in NAFTA is there are things on that tracing list that aren't in cars anymore. And there's a lot of parts and content of vehicles that there aren't trade codes specifically for the motor vehicle industry and would be difficult to have on a tracing list such as that. So they've modernized how they approach content, and is a broader base of the vehicle's parts and components.
Okay. And then in addition, the U.S. and Mexico made an agreement that said 40 to 45% of cars and trucks, or the parts for cars and trucks, now need to be made in places of much higher wages, $16 an hour, both in U.S. but most especially in Mexico. This seems to be a first in any agreement in North America, Michelle. Is that right?
Yes, and that's a big part of the, I think those two things are the biggest changes we've seen with the Mexico agreement. Now, it's not clear how that will be monitored, so there's still a lot of questions around that.
Right. So because the idea is that the overall idea is to raise wages in Mexico so that maybe not as many jobs go from the United States to Mexico, right?
Right. I mean, the whole idea behind updating NAFTA is to create more jobs in the U.S. What's not clear is if this agreement will do that.
Yeah, okay. But here's the thing, though. Congress has authorized fast-track negotiations for NAFTA on a trilateral level, right? Not just a bilateral U.S.-Mexico agreement. So, Kristen, I mean, is there – if Canada isn't in, where does that leave the auto industry?
Well, it's a difficult place for the auto industry, and I think it's a difficult place for where the U.S. and the Mexican negotiators have gotten to. I want to point out, Canada and the U.S. were negotiating bilaterally in the spring while we were leading up to the Mexican election. Mexico came back to the table after the election, carried the ball a little further, and resolved some of the issues that they had outstanding. But I don't think anyone in the Mexican negotiating team thought that these thresholds they were setting would be U.S.-Mexico only. This really only works if Canada's part of the deal.
Okay, so can you clarify that a little bit? Because is this what the Canadian Foreign Minister, Chrystia Freeland, was saying last week when she had mentioned that there was some kind of high-level agreement between the U.S. and Canada in the spring? I mean, do we know what the specifics of that agreement were?
Well, I think what remains for Canada to work out is outside of the auto chapter. Most of the auto chapter, they had come to an agreement on the top line, you know, how they were going to handle parts and regional value content. There is actually another level. So before we had 62.5% on a list of parts. Now we have three hoops to jump through, 75% of the vehicle, And then you have to look at 70% of the metals, the steel and aluminum, have to come from North America. And this new content rule for labor value content, 40% of a car, 45% of a truck must be made in a place, I'm going to say broadly defined, that pays at least $16 an hour. Now, that's not hourly wages. That's a blended rate that includes some R&D labor and some white collar work, as well as the workers on the assembly line. So it's a blended rate.
I see. Okay. But here we are, you know, as of today, where U.S. and Canadian trade negotiators are meeting once again, because it was just, what, last week where Robert Lighthizer did send a note to Congress saying that the administration has an intent to sign a final deal in 90 days, and they have some 30 days to resolve issues with Canada. So the clock is ticking here. I mean, Michelle Krebs, what is all this ongoing uncertainty about NAFTA? What effect is that having on the auto industry right now?
Well, uncertainty is not the auto industry's friend. We are in an industry that is extremely capital intensive and needs a long lead times. For example, right now, auto companies are planning what vehicles they're going to build 4 years from now and where they're going to build them. So they really would like some certainty around what are the rules of the game, how are they going to play by those or pay penalties if they choose not to play by those rules. So they really would just like, you know, what are the rules of the game so they can move forward with planning.
Okay. And if they don't have a clear set of rules, or if Canada's out, then what does that mean? Michelle.
I think there's a lot of different scenarios that they're working on internally. We're not hearing a lot from the auto companies right now. Mm-hmm. They're kind of laying low on this. So, but I think there's a lot of going back and forth about what if this happens, we'll do this, and making plans.
Okay,
alternative plans.
And Kristen, your view on what the uncertainty right now it means, or what effect it's having on auto manufacturers?
Well, I think we resolved some uncertainty on August 27th when we saw some of the details of what the U.S. and Mexico had worked out. Auto stocks jumped a little bit. You know, the auto industry is in uncertainty, in a phase of uncertainty around trade, around fuel economy regulations, around a whole host of things in the midst of some of the biggest technological changes in the vehicle we've ever seen. So, you know, not only are they planning products 4 years out, they have to plan them to meet the regulations, to meet consumer preferences, to meet the economic situation that we'll be in 4 years from now, and, you know, adhere to whatever details of our trade. So, you know, just because they started the clock on Friday, that does mean they have to present to Congress within 30 days the text of the agreement. This sets in motion a whole set of things with the congressional timeline that takes almost a year to get through.
Well, we'll talk more about that when we come back. We're talking about the U.S. auto industry, about American car auto workers, and about car buyers, and what effect the negotiations over NAFTA are going to have over this critical industry in America. We'd love to hear your view. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a bi-weekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
Hey, Tamara.
Hey, Domenico. All week long, Brett Kavanaugh will face his Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, he's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, and there are going to be a lot of questions about how he could transform the Supreme Court for a generation.
The NPR Politics podcast will be following those hearings, and we'll hop in the studio every day to break down what you need to know.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the U.S. auto industry and NAFTA negotiations and the future for U.S. car workers and car buyers as well. I'm joined today by Michelle Krebs. She's senior analyst for autotrader.com, and by Kristen Gicek. She's vice president of industry, labor and economics at the Center of Automotive Research. And Michelle had said a little bit before the break that indeed the auto industry itself is lying quite low right now as negotiations go on, particularly between the United States and Canada about NAFTA. They have released a statement, so I just want to read that to you here. The statement is from the Alliance of Auto Manufacturers, and it says, automakers urge the U.S. and Mexico to quickly re-engage with Canada to continue to build on this progress. The industry is hopeful that any changes to NAFTA auto rules of origin continue to strike the right balance by incentivizing production and investment in North America while keeping new vehicles affordable for more Americans. So, Kristen Gicek, let me just turn to you quickly on that. I mean, do you think the direction that NAFTA is headed, based on what we've seen, the agreement between the U.S. and Mexico, as we were talking about before the break, is that going to keep vehicles affordable or more affordable in America?
No, not necessarily. I think there is some incentive in that deal to move a little bit of work back to the United States. I'm in favor of there being more U.S. jobs in the auto industry. But U.S. wages are higher than those in Mexico, and the cost of implementing expansions or investment that would be required to move work back here is going to be shown in consumer prices. So, you know, I think even just the fact of, you know, complying and showing compliance with these new regulations is going to be costly.
Right. So, Michelle Krebs, let's explore that a little bit more, because, I mean, I want to talk about the downstream effects here of whatever agreement the U.S., Mexico, and Canada come up with, because if the idea is to raise wages and also raise, particularly in Mexico, and also protect jobs in the United States, and as Kristen was saying, that could lead to more expensive cars, could that have the unintended consequence, though, of then ultimately sacrificing some U.S. jobs if car sales go down?
That's exactly our thinking. We fully expect that vehicle prices will go up. Let's remember, we already have aluminum and steel tariffs that are being folded into automaker costs. For now, they've been absorbing that. That surely will be passed on to consumers at some point. So we expect higher vehicle prices, and we would expect probably less choice, because we'll see automakers say, it's not worth it to bring that vehicle in and go through all the hassle and make pay, and we can't pass along to consumers anyway. So there will be probably less choices. We saw that with Ford last week announcing it will not bring in a vehicle that it had planned to from China. Interesting, we did a survey too. Consumers are already very aware of this, which has surprised me. The cost of vehicles are already going up for a number of reasons, and consumers told us that tariffs and the threat of tariffs have them concerned, and particularly young people who are, you know, having the most affordability problems because they're so laden with debt, and they kind of, you know, had a setback with the Great Recession more than the rest of us.
Right. So this, I mean, but this is a kind of a terrible catch-22 then, though, right? That okay. All these efforts going in to renegotiate NAFTA, the point being, for in the eyes of the President of the United States, to help American workers, that it could actually backfire, Kristen.
Well, it could. And, you know, we've looked at this in a paper that we did this spring, looking at basically the outline of where the agreement is now. Our version had the labor value content at 30%, where it's now at 40 and 45. And we did see prices going up. We saw employment going down. And while you may end up with a few more automaker jobs, you know, if you make it more difficult to trade with, say, Canada or the rest of the world, which the U.S. is also considering with additional tariffs in another context, then you make it difficult to export our parts. And our parts industry is very dependent on exports as well, especially to Canada and Mexico. So that free flow in the supply chain creates jobs here. So a car made in Canada or Mexico may have a U.S. engine, transmission, you know, the seat motors or some other parts that come from the United States, it's much more likely that those nearshore production sites have U.S. content than anything that comes to us from outside of North America.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about these tariffs then, though, because the Trump administration, the president himself, has really threatened to slap some very heavy tariffs on imported cars from a number of places, including Canada. And is this the same report that you were referencing? Because I'm seeing that you've previously said that if those tariffs are indeed put into place, that the U.S. could stand to lose as many as 200,000 jobs?
Well, we have two studies out. One about the NAFTA negotiations as they stood this spring, and then one on this, it's called 232. So the U.S. Commerce Department is investigating whether auto and auto parts imports to the United States cause a national security threat. This is the same mechanism they use to impose steel and aluminum tariffs. That report is expected to come out soon. The 200,000 job loss is associated with Canada and Mexico being exempt from those tariffs. If they were not, then we see a 700,000 job loss, or actually more than 700,000. So you may see increases in automaker, so the people who put together and assemble vehicles, but you see losses in virtually every other sector of the economy, including parts, and that far outweighs any gains that you would have in automakers.
Michelle Krebs, 200,000 in the best-case scenario, 700,000 in the worst-case scenario. This sounds not exactly where the Trump administration was hoping to have the kind of effect it was hoping to have.
Right. And I would point out, too, this comes at a time when we are past the peak of this automotive cycle. We have had an amazing run of car sales over the last 7, 8, 9 years since the Great Recession. We set a record for new car sales 2 years ago, and we've been edging downward. And we anticipate a little bit more edging downward. Nothing catastrophic at this point, but edging downward. So it's coming at the wrong time of the automotive cycle, economic cycle.
Huh. We are talking.
And I think
an
important part about that, Michelle, is that we have this existing supply chain and footprint that has been able to supply vehicles and parts at the peak of the market. And they've been able to meet peak demand with that footprint. As the demand softens, investing more to build out more capacity is exactly the wrong thing to be doing from a business standpoint.
Well, we are talking about a number of things. We're talking about U.S. and Canadian negotiations over NAFTA and what effect those negotiations and wherever NAFTA lands might have on the U.S. auto industry as a whole. And, of course, the big picture on North American trade includes the possibility of tariffs on auto parts and cars as well, and what effect that could have on American workers. I'm speaking today with Michelle Krebs. She's senior analyst for autotrader.com. She's joining us from Detroit. And with Kristen Gicek, she's vice president of industry, labor, and economics at the Center of Automotive Research. She's with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan today, and would love to hear from listeners. Like, what do you think about how NAFTA negotiations are going? And if you're in the auto industry in any capacity, what are your concerns or your hopes for the future as the U.S. and Canada especially try to work out their differences? Let's listen here to what the head of Ford, CEO Jim Hackett, told reporters in Canada in January at a car show in Detroit. He said that NAFTA, despite doing a lot of good, he says, for the automotive industry, that it does need a revamp.
Really was a super idea when it came. I think it really helped our industry, helped the world in ways that we all benefited from, but it is in due time that it needed to be modernized.
That's the Ford CEO in January. This past weekend, Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, he was on Fox News. And, you know, the AFL-CIO have long said that the original version of NAFTA was terrible for the American worker. So Fox News's Chris Wallace asked him whether he could support a new NAFTA deal that might possibly leave Canada out. And here's what Richard Trumka said.
Our economies are integrated. The three countries in North America, the economy's pretty integrated. And it's pretty hard to see how that would work without having Canada in the deal. You said that the Mexican deal is closed. There's still a lot of work to be done, even on the Mexican deal, Chris, because the language isn't drafted. We haven't seen whole chapters of the thing. We're anxious to move forward with it and anxious to have all three countries involved.
Kristen Gcheck, I mean, is that what you're hearing? Some anxiety from auto workers and from other parts of the industry as a whole right now?
Absolutely. And, you know, the labor unions are looking for stronger enforcement of the labor provisions that, you know, in the first NAFTA were a side agreement. They were supposed to bring labor conditions and labor enforcement into the main body of the agreement and have really strong mechanisms for making sure that folks adhere to those labor standards. I think they're not seeing the detail they want to see there is what I gather. So, you know, that's a really important part. You know, the labor value content rule, it's not likely that very many folks are going to start paying those, you know, blended $16 an hour wages in Mexico. That to me seems more like that portion of the vehicle has to be made in the U.S. and Canada, and even some parts of the U.S. and Canada wouldn't comply necessarily depending on how they operationalize that. So, you know, it may be good for bringing a certain share of the vehicle back. But if you look at, there's only one set of data that we can see that has anything to do with content. And most vehicles made in the United States right now, a lot of the vehicles made in Mexico and Canada are already compliant with that labor standard.
Right. So Michelle Krebs, let me see if I have this right here, because the details do matter in these discussions always. So for these new parts and value rules that we've been talking about that at least the U.S. and Mexico have negotiated. Do I understand correctly that if cars are being made that don't meet the 75% rule or the $16 wage hour per hour wage, that the auto manufacturers would pay a 2.5% tariff instead?
Correct. And they may choose to do that. So they'll have to weigh, is it worth it to pass that along to the consumer, that the tariff cost, or what does it cost to move those jobs? And it will cost a lot to move jobs.
Okay. So, but I mean,
and that's a side agreement I want to point out. So that, ability to pay 2.5% is currently true. But there's a side agreement between the U.S. and Mexico that exempts a large majority of Mexican output from any additional tariffs or any move the U.S. might make to raise its MFN or most favored nation trading tariff. So Mexico can do that. Our producers in Mexico can pay the 2.5% now, but if there's an imposition of, say, 20-25% tariffs through Section 232, or if we raise the overall tariff rate, only the existing footprint of exports from Mexico will be exempt from that.
Okay, so and therein lies a lot of the problem.
It closes the back door so that nobody can just rush to Mexico and pay 2.5% when the rest of the world is facing 25%.
And Kristen brings up a good point, because there are the devils are in the details of all this, and there are all these side agreements. So all the details have not been worked out.
Okay, because I guess what I'm trying to understand here is, I mean, we're focusing on sort of the effect across North America for any changes in NAFTA on the auto industry, but it really is a global industry too. I mean, is there the possibility, is it outside the realm of extreme possibility that we may end up with an agreement that actually just incentivizes parts manufacturers and auto manufacturers to overlook the U.S. and Mexico entirely and go to, I don't know, China and Malaysia and put more jobs out there?
Yes. I don't know about China right now, since just about everything coming out of China is tariffed.
Right.
And we're in a bit of a situation with them. But there are many other regions of the world that make automotive parts and content and vehicles. In fact, you know, last year, the vehicle sales in the U.S., 48% of vehicles sold in the United States were made somewhere outside the U.S. And of that, 25% were made in Mexico and Canada. So that means you've got 23% coming from some other place. And there's once you're paying a 2.5% tariff, any member of the WTO pays the 2.5% tariff right now. So if you're non-compliant with or non-conforming with the new NAFTA rules, but you can conform with the existing NAFTA rule, that's the little window they've got to be in for Mexican production to come in at the 2.5%. So once you're non-conforming, you can non-conform a lot.
Right.
and have a much lower content from North America.
I see. Well, we
as
are
long as it meets the NAFTA 1.0 rules.
We are talking about the auto industry and how it's watching and waiting as the United States and Canada in particular try to hash out their final differences on what people are hoping for is a modernized NAFTA. You're listening to Kristen Jicek. She is Vice President of Industry, Labor, and Economics at the Center of Automotive Research. And Michelle Krebs is also with us. She's Senior Analyst at Autotrader.com. I want to get a quick call in here. Michael is calling from Dayton, Ohio. You're on the air, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to actually give my input from an auto parts perspective. I've worked in parts for a couple of different years now, and ever since these the trade war has been going on, and we've seen so far, I've seen personally, come down from a couple of different manufacturers of parts that we carry, a couple of different lines, have increases in between 1 and up to 3% across the board on everything that we carry for them. And, that kind of worries me from the standpoint that our customers are already worried about price. Low marks, as it is already with parts.
Yeah.
And so that increase there alone, I don't know how it'll affect the other companies, but from what we're seeing already, I almost wonder how much that's really going to affect us in the long term across the board.
Michael, can I just ask you quickly, how much do you think it's going to affect you in the long term?
I think it's going to, I think there's a certain level of necessity. People are going to need their cars fixed. There definitely will be not so much impact people will be willing to keep that cost. But at a certain point, I think on some of the bigger jobs, people will just end up rather just letting their car be, stay unfixed.
Yeah.
If it comes to that because of the cost. So I think it can affect parts and then just automotive repair in general pretty significantly, at least in the long term. I think we're just seeing the tip of it now.
Michael, thank you so much for your call. Michelle Krebs, we just got a couple seconds before I got to take a break here. He's talking about the parts and repair also being impacted.
Excellent point. And what we do expect is because prices will rise in the new vehicle market, people may be frozen out, not able to afford, they'll turn to the used car market. And we've actually seen that this summer. But they'll need parts to fix those vehicles, and those prices will go up as well.
Well, we will be back in just a moment. We're talking about the U.S. auto industry and what effect NAFTA negotiations might have on it and have on American auto workers and car buyers as well. Michelle Krebs joins us. She's Senior Analyst at Auto Trader. Kristen Jicek is also with us. She's Vice President at the Center of Automotive Research. We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about NAFTA and the U.S. auto industry? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As soon as you wake up, you need the latest. That's why Up First is here. It's NPR's morning news podcast. In just 10 minutes or so, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about NAFTA and the U.S. auto industry. As you probably heard last week, the U.S. and Mexico reached a bilateral agreement, but Congress has only fast-tracked authority for the Trump administration to renegotiate a trilateral agreement. So today, the U.S. and Canada are back at the negotiating table trying to hash out their last differences over NAFTA. And just last week, Canada's foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, talked with reporters. And she talked about how she and her U.S. counterpart, Bob Lighthizer, actually really know each other's negotiating positions so well that at times it seems like they could almost negotiate for each other.
I know that Ambassador Lighthizer has a very good understanding of the Canadian positions. Bob and I joke sometimes that we could switch chairs. We know each other's positions so well. And we're working hard to find that win-win, that win-win space.
But they haven't found it yet, and the clock is somewhat ticking on reaching an agreement. I'm joined today by Michelle Krebs. She's senior analyst for Auto Trader, and by Kristen Gicek. She's vice president of industry, labor, and economics at the Center of Automotive Research. And let's go to a call here. Eric is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're on the air, Eric.
Hi. So I just wanted to introduce in the conversation that the importance of those side agreements and more broadly on the environmental and labor provisions, which were part of the negotiations, which would address not just labor standards and environmental standards, but relate closely to all of the tariff negotiations, including the auto industry. And as part of the team back then, it was really important that all three countries be involved, mostly because often the Canadians, with respect to labor and environmental standards, supported the U.S. position. And so it was huge leverage having two of the parties to the agreement very much on the same page in terms of making labor and environmental standards enforceable, which is the whole issue, right? Can you take a labor standards and environmental standards issue to this kind of dispute settlement that you can in other parts of the agreement? And so I think I just wonder what the panel thinks about not having the strategy where we're trying to do these bilateral negotiations, which frankly may not be in the best interest of the United States, if in fact we agree that we ought to be putting American workers and protecting the North American environment on even par with trade with tariff negotiations.
Eric, thank you so much for your call and your question. Michelle Krebs, let me turn that to you.
Wow, that's a tough one.
Yeah, it is.
You know, times have vastly changed. I just would hope that we can come to an agreement that works. The best agreements are win-win-win, and I hope that that's where we get to. Maybe Kristen has a better answer than that.
Well, I think, you know, an interesting point here is it has long been that the U.S. and Canada would be very closely aligned on these issues. Canada and Mexico are aligned on a number of issues as well. They are both parties to the newly signed CPTPP. That's the Trans-Pacific Partnership that lives on without the United States in it. That involves Japan and a number of other countries. Canada and Mexico have also signed memorandums of understanding with California on adherence to the Paris Accords and fuel economy regulations and air quality. While it has long been the case that the U.S. and Canada would be aligned on labor and environmental standards, Mexico's not that far out any longer. The enforcement, though, of those standards is really important, and having an enforcement mechanism that is transparent and that works is, you know, why you will see some criticisms from environmentalists, from labor groups.
Mm.
Well, we don't yet know what that is.
Let's get another call. Mark is calling from Newport Richey, Florida. You're on the air, Mark.
Hello. Just wanted to respond to the information that you spoke about of NAFTA and how it affected the automotive prices. Everything that was said is basically true. However, what we are failing to look at is that once the price of the new car goes up, that drives the price of the trade-in up of the used car. So if the price of the new car went up $1,000, there's a good chance with the used car demand so much higher that the price of the used car trade-in will go up the same. So the trade difference would be practically the same, okay? Also with parts, most of the parts that are used to fix used cars are refurbished parts that are already in the mainstream of the part department.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have 38 years in the automotive industry. I've traveled all over the United States. I've seen all different types of effects from interest rates, trades, this, that, you name it, over the last 38 years. So although the information that you're saying is correct, this NAFTA negotiations is a temporary one.
Uh-huh.
Once it is agreed upon, the benefits to the automotive industry and our country are huge.
Mark, thank you so much for your call and for your perspective. 38 years, you said, in the auto industry. Michelle Krebs, would you like to respond to that? Mark's saying, you know, he's feeling much more optimistic.
Well, he's raising a great point because we saw an interesting phenomenon. Cox Automotive owns Manheim Auto Auctions, which are the wholesale auctions that sell to dealers. And this summer, we've seen something we've never seen before. Typically, used car prices at our auctions go down in the summer. This year, they are going up. They've been going up since June. And we do think it's because there's stronger demand for used cars, and because consumers want to switch to used cars from new cars, and dealers are stocking up to sell those to consumers. But it may be short-lived because, you know, you have to have new car sales to produce used cars. And if new car sales go down, we just simply won't have as many. If you look back, we don't have a lot of used cars that are in that 8 to 10-year-old vintage. Why? We didn't sell a lot of cars during the Great Recession.
Right.
So there's a shortage of that group.
Okay. Kristen Gcheck, we've just got a couple minutes left to go here. And I want to take a step back, if I could, with you for a moment, because you're from Flint. Is that right?
I am from Flint, Michigan. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you grew up there. So, am I? I don't mean to be too nosy, but am I right to say that, like, you remember Flint in its heyday with what, tens of thousands of automotive jobs there?
I do, 80,000 GM jobs in my childhood. One of my first jobs was working for General Motors. In fact.
Wow. Okay, so 80,000, and now fewer than 10,000 in Flint.
Right.
Okay. The reason why I ask that is because, I mean, you know, to our caller's point earlier, we're really focused on the immediate effects of NAFTA and the auto industry because that's kind of where the heat is now. But we also, I just wanted to sort of take that longer view with you. You've seen the generation-long change that this industry and its workers have gone through. So when you look forward, you know, past these NAFTA negotiations, I mean, what should we be focusing on? Does the long-term future for U.S. auto workers look bright?
That's a really good question. You know, I think, you know, we get mixed up, I think, a lot with trade and talking about how trade and employment are related, and they absolutely are. But there's a million reasons why there aren't 80,000 GM workers in Flint right now. Trade is one of them. Technology is one of them. You know, the increasing automation in the plants. We just organize work better, and labor productivity has gone up. The strength of the UAW has waned, and that means that, you know, the person who pushes the broom in the factory now works for such and such environmental services and is not counted as an auto worker anymore. There's more temps, there's more contract workers in the plants. They don't count as auto workers anymore. Sequencing and kitting is done in the plant by a third party. They're not auto workers anymore.
Huh.
And a larger share of the vehicles made by the supplier sector, and not all of them have a North American industry code that counts them in the automotive industry. So there's a whole host of reasons why there are fewer auto workers in Flint, Michigan. Is there a future? Yes. I think, you know, absolutely we're going to continue to build vehicles in the market where we sell them. The work is going to be different and change dramatically. I think there's still an auto industry in Michigan and in the United States.
Well, Kristen Gcheck, Vice President of Industry, Labor, and Economics at the Center of Automotive Research, joining us today from Ann Arbor. Thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
And Michelle Krebs, Senior Analyst for Autotrader.com, with us today from Detroit. Michelle, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, we'll be back in just a moment. We'll talk about Nike's decision to make Colin Kaepernick the face of its signature ad campaign. This is On Point. Well, the ad is a powerful black and white close-up of Colin Kaepernick. The text is simple. Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything. Just do it. Nike's new campaign features the former NFL quarterback who started the movement of kneeling during the national anthem to protest police violence. And this new ad campaign, it has its fans, including LeBron James and Serena Williams. It has its detractors as well, because not everyone is cheering. President Trump today tweeted, quote, "Just like the NFL, whose ratings have gone way down, Nike is getting absolutely killed with anger and boycotts." Well, joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia, to unpack this is David Dennis. He's writer and journalism professor at Morehouse College. His op-ed for the African-American news site News One is called "Colin Kaepernick is Beating the NFL. Here's How." We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. David Dennis, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, your quick take. Colin Kaepernick is beating the NFL. Here's how. Give me the answer. How?
Well, quite frankly, he's just beating them by, you know, standing for what he believes in. The NFL pretty much took him for granted, which, I mean, is sort of conceivable to think about a couple years ago, that one guy who's barely a starter for you know, a team that wasn't good, deciding to sit down and not say anything could, you know, damage the league so badly. But they just sort of you know, the owners were offended by what he did, a lot of some players, a lot of fans, and so they sort of buckled down and tried to attack him and sort of underestimated his power, the power of what he represented, and the fans who would rally behind him. And then also now they're understanding just how bad that is, because now they have a billion-dollar, you know, multi-billion-dollar organization, company that is backing him and what he stands for. So this is you know, something that is going to be, it's a PR nightmare already for the NFL, and then there's a legal nightmare because he has a, you know, collusion sort of case against them that is, you know, proceeding in court.
But it's interesting, though, because I'm thinking from Nike's perspective, they do have a history of using controversies for commercial purposes. Is that sort of, I don't know, watering down Colin Kaepernick's message that it has become, you know, an advertisement?
Yeah, I mean, there is, I mean, everybody's well within their right to have a very healthy skepticism of Nike. It's not generally great to feel like a big corporation is co-opting a movement. However, Nike, what Nike understands, what the NFL doesn't understand, is that, you know, black culture and, you know, black people who are following Kaepernick, we are sort of determining, black culture in America sort of determines what's cool, sort of moves the needle, sort of determines what, who's buying Nike, who's watching NFL, who's part of these products. And so Nike put themselves under the scope of exactly those people. I mean, they are, you know, getting outraged from the right, but if they, you know, bungle this move with Kaepernick, then they're going to get the ire of, you know, the big black consumer base that has made Nike cool in the first place. So they have to tread carefully. And, you know, as much as there may be a temptation to tamp down his statement or his movement, doing so, or even an indication that they are doing so, is going to, you know, sort of turn this thing against them, and everybody's going to be against Nike. So I think they're going to be a little bit more careful because they don't really have a choice.
Okay. But you know, I, on the day that the ad campaign was released and soon thereafter, I think Nike's share price dropped something like 2-3%, which is a big drop over the course of a couple of days. And we've got a comment here from John Evergreen, because you were talking a little bit earlier, David, about, yes, there is definitely controversy around this. And John's asking, why would Nike do something so controversial at the expense of its stockholders? Even if it turns out to be good for them, it's too risky of a move to be anything less than fiduciary negligence in order to attack the president on this issue. That's how he sees it.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of money in this. I mean, Nike wouldn't do this unless they understood that there was money at the end of it. I mean, from what I understand, the stock prices are recovering today, and we haven't even seen the product yet. I mean, once Kaepernick product starts hitting the market and we start seeing shoes and apparel and people are lining up for it, I mean, they have been able to cultivate a passion from consumers that is really hard to buy from, you know, big corporations. And I think, you know, I think the stock price, I think that's probably, it seems like a temporary drop. And I think that they are betting on the passion for the move will outweigh the passion against the move. I mean, we've seen these protests against places like Starbucks, against Disney, that have really not gone anywhere, have not had really a huge impact when these companies sort of embrace diversity and embrace sort of these movements, or they, you know, get on the wrong side of Fox News. So I think Nike's looking at that, and they're seeing that they can, you know, they can handle this temporary outrage and go to a bigger bottom line down the line.
Hmm. A listener on Facebook, Steve Callahan, says demographics are with Nike. His younger folks, this is Steve's comment from Facebook, saying younger folks are with Cap and are aware about police brutality and by extension inherent inequality. And he says that Fox viewers and NFL fans are older and scared of change. I mean, I would say that NFL fans maybe are more diverse than that, but does Steve have a point?
Yeah, I mean, Nike, you know, understands this is a youth movement. Kaepernick movement is a youth movement. You know, the NFL has an interesting demographic. They have more, is the only league they have as majority black league, majority white fans. They're sort of trying to toe that line between the players and the fans. Nike sort of understands where its bread is buttered, and that's right in the heart of black culture. And Kaepernick has tapped into the heart of black culture and black movement. And, you know, I think Nike can see that way through, as we've seen, you know, NFL, the star is having more issues with that.
Yeah. We got 30 seconds to go here, David. I mean, I just want to ask you maybe again, there are protests against this ad campaign. I mean, we've been seeing on social media people burning their Nikes and cutting them up. That could have an effect.
Yeah, I mean, I will, you know, we've seen a lot of sort of the more grandiose gestures of the cutting the Nikes and the burning, but a lot of the sort of tweets and the hashtag have been mocking those few people. Like I said, these protests against, you know, diversity and against these movements have not really moved the needle negatively for a lot of these brands as they've right. sort of embraced it.
Well, David Dennis is writer and journalism professor at Morehouse College. We've got links to his writings on Colin Kaepernick at onpointradio.org. He's with us today from Atlanta. David Dennis, thank you so very much.
All right, thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.